And with me in the KRVS studios this afternoon are Duncan Thistlewaite and Brady McKellar, here to talk about the play Red by playwright John Logan, being produced by Wanderlust Theater. It opens on the 9th, which is next week, and will run at Theater 810 through that week. The play Red, it doesn't jump right out at you what it's about.
Communism,
I don't know. Maybe.
Apples.
And many of our listeners may not know the character that this play is based upon. It's the artist Mark Rothko, and there are only two characters in the play, Mark Rothko and his assistant. Duncan, you play the
Mark
artist,
mm-hmm.
and Brady, you play Ken,
right.
who is his assistant in this play, actually based upon a real person.
Right, yes.
We'll talk
yes.
about in a little while. But for those people in our audience who don't know about Mark Rothko, maybe have heard the phrase the Rothko Chapel in Houston, but don't know much about him. Perhaps we can start off talking about who he was and why a play was written about him and why we should really care about him.
Well, he was Marcus Rothkowitz, and it's one of the parts of the play is talking about how his name emerged, you know, changed and morphed into Mark Rothko. And he was a famous abstract expressionist. He was a Russian Jew. I think he came to the United States when he was 10, and his family lived in Portland, Oregon, and he was brilliant. He's, you know, a standout student and won a full scholarship to Yale, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And I think it was on the Yale campus that he fell into almost accidentally painting. There was nothing in his early childhood or background to really predict that he would do this, but at Yale he found himself there, and it spoke to him, and he pursued it. And what else can I say about him? His career was one of development and ever, you know, increasing fame. And as an abstract expressionist, he helped really define the movement. Mm-hmm. And at the end of his career, he was a titan in an American painter, American mm-hmm. abstract painter.
Mm-hmm. And his final works were what we mentioned a little bit earlier, the Rothko Chapel
right.
in Houston mm-hmm. that were commissioned, that set there, that are absolutely beautiful. But again, for those people who don't know him, and when you say he's a titan in the art world, describe what he became and what he's really known for. When you say Mark Rothko, certain images come to people's head.
Well, that's a tall
Brady,
order.
Maybe.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to sit here and try to describe the work of Mark Rothko in any way.
Go ahead.
No, well, I was hoping that you would jump in there.
You know, as this is radio, we can't flash any images up on the screen.
I know. I was just thinking if we could go to the screen for a moment. No, especially as we get on to the period in which our play takes place, a lot of his work revolves around large patches of very bright or very bold color choices, not always bright color choices. And then within them there are these dark, often black, sometimes blue-black geometric shapes, usually squares or rectangles or things of that nature. So that's kind of, I guess, if you were mm-hmm. going to describe the iconic
– very large pieces.
Huge. We actually had in our piece, you know, we do some business on stage with painting and things like that. And it was like, what's the maximum canvas that I could move by myself so mm-hmm. that we could paint on that? And so
was it as large as his?
Well, here's what happened. I actually went down to the theater and measured all the diagonal space in the entrance doors and the entrance doors to the theater mm-hmm. to see what's the biggest size canvas we could get in there. And that mm-hmm. was an 8x8,
right.
which is, you know, that's
pretty large.
It's pretty large.
But his were – how large?
He had some
chapel.
That were, I mean, 12 by 12.
Yeah,
I mean, he
huge.
Had some massive, you know,
monumental.
Massive pieces.
Right. And the ones at the chapel in Houston are just extraordinary.
Right. Now, the ones at the chapel in Houston, of course, they are enclosed within a building, but they are very dark.
Well, you know, his palette changed mm-hmm. throughout his whole painting career, not only from figurative work. His early work is figurative, you know, people in subways and but you know, he employed a wide-ranging palette at the beginning, mm-hmm. but it changed as his mm. as the shapes he chose changed,
right.
and they got more somber as he became older until at the end, his paintings are called things like Black on Gray and, you know, that sort of thing.
Black on Black.
So, and there is some discussion about that in the text of the play.
I asked that because that, I guess I read a quote from that, and it has to do with this worry about the colors and worry about the paintings and what might happen to them. So the play is called Red. It actually came out just a few years ago, 2010, and was nominated for all kinds
of six Tonys, including Play of the Year, which is, you know, something.
Right. So people responded to it very, very well. So just having given people a little bit of background about who he was, let's talk about the play and why it affected people so much as a play. Maybe you can just set it up for us, Duncan.
Well, it's about the dynamics of this relationship between this man, this very powerful intellectual, dynamic person, and his young assistant at a time when he was really at the peak of his powers. I mean, he had just received what the play calls, in one of the interchanges in the play calls, the flashiest commission since the Sistine Chapel.
Right.
He was paid an exorbitant amount of money to do this series of murals for the Four Seasons restaurant in the Seagram building. And he was hired by the two architects who designed the building specifically to provide the decoration, I guess you'd say, although he would spin in it. He's spinning in his grave now mentioned that for the walls of the restaurant. And so that's really what the play hinges upon as one aspect of the human aspect is the nature of our relationship and how that changes and what we get from each other.
Right. Now, I don't want to do a spoiler thing, but within the play, I have not read it, within the play, do we find out the outcome of what happens eventually?
Yes. You walk away. I think it closes off very well.
Okay.
Originally, Rothko pulled out of the Seagram commission, but nobody ever really knew why.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of what happens in this play as we get towards the end is kind of speculative, but there is an actual closure. There's actually two closures that take place in the process of the play. So it's a very good play. It's one of those things where it's really about the story of two people. But it's fascinatingly wrapped up in this wonderful kind of cornucopia of art and expression and talent and what does this mean and where does this come from. And I think that's another thing that the play does very well is it's like, you know, abstract expressionism is maybe not the easiest art form to really understand. You know, there's even a line that in the play where it's like, look at all these fuzzy rectangles, you know.
My kid could do that in kindergarten.
Right. And I think something that the play does very, very well is it explains this art form and what it means particularly to this one individual, to Mark Rothko, and what his process is in creating it and bringing it to life and the why of it. And it's really remarkable to have – kind of a misunderstood style of art to be so elegantly explained through the course of this play, which is, again, really about these two people and their relationship.
And so the two people, your character is Ken. He doesn't even have a last name within the play.
Right.
He's sort of fictional, but
well, I mean, don't sell me short now.
No, no, no.
I mean, like, let's not – I have an important role, okay?
That's what I'm getting to. He is based upon a real character.
Yes.
And did John Logan – how did he work that character in there? I mean, you describe Rothko as a titan. How does he shape your character in this play?
My character is there to provide a number of different roles. You know, it's kind of funny because in the early this is off topic a little, but not entirely. In the early Batman comic serials, there was a lot of these things of like Batman talking to himself and talking to himself and talking to himself. And they realized that what they really needed was for Batman to have this kind of a sidekick so that he was no longer speaking only to himself and he could kind of have this back and forth kind of a discussion in which Batman, the lead character, was still the primary motivator of that dialogue. And early on in the play, you know, my character kind of fills that role. I'm there to help out. I'm there for Rothko I'm there to go get the laundry and to pick up food and make coffee and do everything that he wants. But then as the play develops, the role of my character becomes more and more active. More and more, I think, not only understanding of the world of the play, but the understanding of the art form and the understanding of Rothko as an artist and as a human. And kind of that's where that relationship builds into.
Mm-hmm. Well, describe Rothko as a human, Duncan. You've been living in his character for a while now. You've done research on him. So at this moment in his life, when he encounters Ken and he's working on this commission, describe him as a human. What is his interior like?
He's sort of a strange amalgam of opposites.
Yes.
This huge, gregarious, sort of Jewish academic dude who wasn't – he didn't really practice his faith. But this huge, energetic man full of ideas and full of accomplishment and notoriety and power. I mean, he was a powerful figure. But at the same time, he was completely insecure at his deepest levels. And you see some of that in the play, his unsure self-image and where he would end up in the history of art and in history of his movement, which – and one of the parts – part of the play examines that is that his movement, the abstract expression movement, was being overtaken by pop art. And so he worries about his place in history. And so a man of great security and a man of – complete insecurities at the mm-hmm. same time.
So he's looking at in the anthologies when the 60s is dealt with, is Warhol's face going to be before his and all of his work
exactly.
and
right.
be pushed to
well,
that?
Well, and I think that's another reason that I think that the play speaks so successfully to so many people is because it really deals with that duality of person, you know, and here's the life of the artist who is very successful and very proud, but at the same time is constantly concerned about what they're leaving behind and are they doing the best they could be doing and how is the public going to accept their work. And again, I think it's that duality that really makes people moved by the piece because mm-hmm. you see the inside of the person in that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes. And I'm sure as a young artist, you're talking about him having gone to Yale and encountered a group of artists and they're very conscious of who they pushed out of the way.
Absolutely.
As well in their time.
Yeah, the part of the play discusses how they destroyed cubism. Mm-hmm. He says at one point, he says, no one can paint a cubist painting today because he and all of his contemporaries, Barnett, Newman, and all the people that you can – the other abstract expressionists, he says in the play, they stomped cubism to death. You know, and
so
they
he
did.
Knows that
and
somebody could stomp him.
Mm-hmm. He doesn't
Absolutely.
See it at that point because he's at the height of his powers. But then as pop art invades the art scene, he's confronted with that. And part of Ken's – sort of job in the play is to force Rothko to look at what's happening, mm-hmm. you know.
I want to tell people who might just be tuning in, we're talking about the play Red, written by playwright John Logan. My guests, Duncan Thistlewaite and Brady McKellar, are in the play. Duncan is Mark Rothko, the artist, and Brady McKellar plays his assistant. There's just two people, very intense play. Again, it is produced by Wanderlust Theater. So how does this relationship start off? We have this amazing artist, a titan in the world, height of his powers, and you come in. What are you like in the beginning of this relationship?
I'm very small. You know, very small.
Overeager undergraduate is how I describe him.
Right, right. And that's after we've known each other for 2 years. He still describes me as an overeager undergraduate. And so, you know, I'm coming into this world. I was hired, you know, by one of his agents to just basically be a shop hand, you know. I mean, I am an aspiring artist. But so I'm hoping, you know, to come in contact with this kind of a greatness, but very, very small and eager to learn and but also abused a little bit.
Well, describe your kind of intellectual background that allows you later in the play to what's your background?
Well, actually, my character itself that does not have a lot of artistic mm-hmm. background, and that's something that sort of develops as the play develops because mm-hmm. in that very first scene.
But you are a painter.
Well, I am.
Absolutely.
I am a painter. Not that you would know.
I don't care. Rothko doesn't care.
But in that very first scene, you know, he's saying, hey, have you read Nietzsche's Birth of Tragedy? And I'm like, what? And he's like, have you read this? Have you read this? Have you read this? And I'm like, I have not read any of these things. And so early on, it really shows that I do not have nearly the intellectual – vocabulary or fortitude that Rothko does. But then as the play goes on, you can actually see my character begin to rise because we have these conversations. Usually I am corrected as I try to understand things, but then as it moves forward and forward and forward, my intellectual understanding and my arts understanding increases until we get to kind of that pivotal moment between the two of us.
It's almost a parity gets reached in a way, even though I have all the stature and all that stuff. But the ideas that we throw back and forth, he comes up and sort of he meets me. Mm-hmm. At the center of the play, sort of.
And where is that coming from? Is it because of instruction from Rothko? Is it something within the character himself? Where does that rise from?
You know, I think it can come from a variety of different places. And I think that early on, there are a couple of moments where Rothko says something and I'm like, but what about this? And he's like, no, this. And then as the play goes on, I think in a lot of times I'm still thinking about those first couple of things. And then how do those first couple of things that we said then apply to what is happening right now? And so all of that stuff sort of builds up together until it's kind of a situation where one compares what they say with what is actually being done. And then, you know, it's kind of a here's a mirror to your action or something of that nature.
Right. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of – he mentions Nietzsche's The Birth of Tragedy.
And that was a piece that really affected Rothko.
Absolutely.
I think it was a seminal work for him.
And it's about the really mythological dualities in life and existence and those giant subjects. And he takes that to heart and we see him understand these concepts. We have this long, involved discussion about – these dualities, and sure enough, Ken has absorbed them and understands them and can stand and speak with Rothko about them at the center of the play. And mm-hmm. it's sort of really a lovely movement to see his evolution mm-hmm. and this sort of reaching parity, even though I'm the dude and he's the assistant. You know,
that sounds like a great title for the play, the dude and the assistant.
The dude and the assistant. That's actually, it's a sequel that we're working
right.
on.
Okay, all right. We're glad to know there's a sequel to this. So even though you don't have that literary vocabulary mm-hmm. and background, as you said, somehow just, it sounds like just the passion of Rothko and the depth of his understanding of philosophy and art somehow inspire emotions and responses in you.
Oh, yes. I mean, and a lot of it, I mean, the script is an extraordinarily well-written script, mm-hmm. but working with Duncan is just absolutely amazing on this because of the craftsmanship of the words and the way that it's presented and the energy and the momentum that it builds. You know, me as Ken, I cannot help but be caught up and be educated and mm-hmm. be involved and meet those artistic challenges mm-hmm. because of the way that Duncan is very effectively bringing this character to life. It's outstanding to be on stage with him.
The check is in the mail, babe.
People
Thank
didn't
you so
see
much.
Duncan turning red there. Well, so describe Duncan then, what you did to put yourself in that character. That's because he's describing an incredibly powerful person in life and powerfully written by John Logan. Did you sit and stare at his paintings for a long time?
I did a lot of that, and mm-hmm. especially looking at the progression. We were talking about this in the lobby before, how you can really see how he progressed from figurative work into these huge forms. But as far as for playing him, and if you look at how people that have done the show, the prominent people that have done the show, who they cast, like Alfred Molina, he's a giant mm-hmm. dude. You know, he's mm-hmm. sort of hefty mm-hmm. and big and tall and usually bald. Well, I'm sort of slight and I have hair and, you know, I don't look anything physically like him. But to sort of get inside the character, you start, of course, with the script and the ideas presented in the script. And so there's a lot of research that's behind me trying to figure out what this guy is like, you know. Mm-hmm. And so so that's sort of how I approached it, through the script and through the extensive amount of name dropping of literary figures and movements of thought and movements in art, trying to assimilate that to enough of a degree to kind of figure out where he is.
So you pulled out your copy of the Portable Nietzsche and
absolutely.
Well, no, it was very fascinating because we went out to Duncan's for our first read through of the play. And when we walked in, he had this board that was set up on the wall of his shop. And on it, he had scores of photographs of the work of Rothko, but then he had printouts of all the different paintings that Rothko mentions and discusses in the work, architecture that's mentioned in the work, photograph of the Seagram Corporation building, all of the locations that he discusses and all that sort of stuff, which has been very good to really bring that, you know, to life. I mean, both for his work, but also for me to have that visual imagery of the things that he's concocting. Because again, my character comes in with not nearly the artistic background, but
no, but you would know of Rothko and all of
right.
these things that he's talking
right
about, his reputation.
Right. So it was really wonderful that way. Plus, I think that the character. I'm speaking for you, and I apologize.
No,
I'm going to keep going.
I'm glad that you
he
are.
Doesn't get to do this on stage. So.
You just be quiet. Be quiet. It's my turn. I also think that a lot of what the character deals with those artistic insecurities, which is something that – I mean, I know that I deal with, and I imagine that – I don't know. I'm speaking for you again. But,
yes, you are totally insecure.
You know,
so,
and
yes.
so that's something that, you know, we as artisans deal with regularly, you know, is that kind of feeling about I feel like I'm doing good, and at the same time – I think that people probably hate my work, you know, and it's a unique kind
it's
of
like
a position
to be in. Like
the
theater is full now, but the next production, maybe nobody will.
Right, no, absolutely.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what Brady said is true. It's a play full of names and figures that require an image to be associated with them. So the wall he's talking about was me trying to have a visual image so that me, the actor, could have that to pull from as, you know, as we worked on the script. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't talk about Rousseau without seeing what Rousseau's paintings were like, mm-hmm. you know, and so mm-hmm. there was a lot of that.
Well, and you're very visual. In addition to being an actor, you're a set designer as well. Mm-hmm. And did you design the set for this?
Nope. No, Elsa designed it.
Elsa did that. And
she did.
How, what was your response to it?
Can I help? That was my response. No, actually, I got to paint, you know, some of his paintings are represented, the 8x8 I talked mm-hmm. about and some mm-hmm. other large paintings that of his that I sort of copied. Mm-hmm. So I got to do that. She let me do that, which was really nice.
Yeah. Well, how important is the set to this? Because we're talking about two artists here. Obviously, one huge in you know, artist's mythology. Their studios are very important to them. Their, mm-hmm. The pieces of art are very important to them. How much went into the thought? And Elsa's not here, so you can't speak for her right now. How important was that in this play? Because there's only two characters. Your two characters.
I feel like the set is vitally important.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I mean, and
what he did, he lived in one part of Manhattan, but he liked to work way far away from his residential neighborhood, so we rented a gymnasium in the Bowery specifically to paint the paintings for the Seagram's building. Mm-hmm. And so that's – and all the sets, the pictures that you see of the Broadway production and stuff are, you know, a gymnasium that has been reconstituted into an art studio, and that's sort of what we have. We've sort mm-hmm. of made
– But we're at Theater 810, so it's really – it's a corner of that
right,
gymnasium.
A fraction.
It's
of
like the
but no,
room.
But no, the set's very important. You know, there are a lot of things that we move around and things that we pick up and do, and everything that we do on stage is real business. Like there is a scene that we are actually painting live, this 6x6 foot canvas, and prior to that in the scene I am stretching and finishing the canvas that we're doing, and Duncan is mixing the pigments into the paint that we're going to be using. We have a live phonograph. And we change the records on it just like we normally would.
Sort of a competition with those records too?
No, I get to choose the record.
When I pay, he says there's actually a line in the play that when I pay the rent, I can choose the records.
Right. I come in one day and he's got some jazz on, and that just doesn't fly.
It's Chet Baker.
I don't care.
About Rothko's painting, that doesn't go.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't go at all. And so there's live food and there's tool use. And like all of the business is very live mm-hmm. business. It is. There's a lot of physicality. Mm-hmm. And we talked about with the record player and also with the lighting. We talk a lot about the lighting because Rothko is very particular about what kind of light was you could view his paintings under. And so we actually talked about it. That light and sound is almost another character in this play because mm-hmm. of how much we talk about it and we deal with it. And we go over and we turn the lights up and then we turn the lights down and we look at things again. And it's a very, very visceral, real kind of mm-hmm. very active business of the play.
It sounds like anybody interested in art, in artist, would just love to see this play.
Well, I certainly hope so.
Relish in this discussion of what goes into creating art. Did the two of you find that you're both talking about being artists in your own right, actors, set designers, you work with plays, you work with puppets, mm-hmm. you create things. Did it have any effect on your own sense of yourselves as artists? You both mentioned feeling insecure at some times about your own art. Did it get you thinking in a very personal way about how you approach that whole idea of being an artist and the insecurity? And did it help you personally grapple with any of that?
Well, I have to say that as an actor, the script is daunting. Mm-hmm. It's dense beyond I've never had another script like this that was so dense with information and ideas and really monumental ideas and large things flying around in the idea space. And to get sort of your mouth around all of that is a challenge. We're still in rehearsal, and it's a continuing challenge to master this script because it's so dense.
Well, what a pleasure for actors to have a dense script.
Absolutely. Oh, it's wonderful. It's mm-hmm. wonderful.
It's not. It's you know. It's a good man, Charlie Brown. It's nothing like that.
No. It's really. It's a. I mean, it really is. It's a get in there and dig around and what do these words mean and. And does this word mean something different in the way that I've said it and in the way that he's just used it? And why is that difference important to the story that we're telling? It's very, very fascinating.
Mm-hmm. And you'll probably never say that word again in your life without thinking about
no,
it.
No, probably not. I mean, there are some mm-hmm. key words that, mm-hmm. that you're like, oh, yeah, you know, it pulls it right back to there. And it probably will for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Have the two of you been to the Rothko Chapel?
No. I have cousins in Houston. And funny story, my cousin went to the Rothko Chapel, and you know it features his largest black on grays and really dark canvases. And so my cousin says, you know, I went there and I walked in, and he says, I thought they had taken all the paintings down because all they were black walls. Well, those were the paintings, you see. And so we had a good laugh about that. But I hope to go yeah. before the show, but I won't be able to.
We were talking about trying to take a company trip, but mm-hmm. you know, it was one of those mm-hmm. situations where it's like we could go, but we couldn't rehearse that day. And we were like, well, let's do rehearsal. You know, we'll go right after the show, and that'll be like our reward.
That's right.
You know, because right now yeah. we're just trying to focus yeah. on, you know, focus on
the work. You need to work on the density of those words.
Plus, that yeah. happened. The chapel was after yes. our play, so we don't need that information
no,
right. yet.
No. You don't know because he does.
But it'll be a fun treat, yeah. you know,
because he does talk about that again. Back to that idea of what happens when the red goes away.
Mm-hmm. And well, I think yeah. the a good many of the Seagram's murals he donated to the Tate in London, wasn't it? What
was it? I think so, but you mm-hmm. would know better than I.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what
well,
he did.
Well, that's for that sequel y'all are talking about.
Right, exactly. Right.
Red 2. The dude and the assistant.
Right. Red 3D. So he worked hard to place his paintings in places where he thought they needed to be so that their power could be perceived by the viewer. Mm-hmm. You can't – it's not a stroll through sort of art gallery experience with Rothko. Yeah. You have to sit there and let – the paintings work, and his technique actually allows the paintings to visually move. That's one of the powers of these giant canvases, is that if you sit there and allow them to enfold you, mm-hmm. they will take on a life, a visual kinetic life of their own, and it's an actual thing. It's not an optical illusion, but it's something like that. They do have a power to shift mm-hmm. and move and flux.
But if you allow it to happen.
You have to allow it to happen. It takes time.
Was that one of the problems with the Seagram's commission?
That was exactly
Well, it was. And it gets discussed in the play that, you know, you have to be a compassionate human being for these paintings to be able to work on you. And one of the issues was that they would not get the appropriate attention.
These would be people at lunch.
For the paintings. Exactly. The have you seen this play? Golly.
She knows.
Y'all said something. I'm just channeling.
You cheated,
you
didn't
all
you?
You all are so passionate about the thing. We're talking about the play Red by John Logan. Again, it came out in 2010, got all kinds of awards and wonderful reviews. Wanderlust Theater is producing it in Lafayette. We have an opportunity to see it. It opens next week on the 9th and will run through the 13th at Theater 810 in downtown Lafayette. Mm-hmm. It's being directed by Elsa Dimitriadis, who is also a part of Wanderlust Theater. And you can get tickets now by calling Theater 810?
Yes. You can get tickets by calling Theater 810, and that number is 484-0172. You can make reservations that way, or you can also go to Wanderlust Red, that's all one word, wanderlustred.eventbrite.com for tickets.
Okay, and then we do remind people that it's a very intimate theater, about 50 seats. Mm-hmm. Really good idea to reserve your tickets ahead
Absolutely.
Of time. The play Red, my guests, Duncan Thistlewaite and Brady McKellar, are acting in it, about the artist Mark Rothko and his assistant Ken. We have the opportunity to see it here, and thank you both for your time.
Thank you so much
for having us.